Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our House Committee on Transportation Policy this actually quite fine Wednesday, April 19th, 2017. Has everybody had a chance to take a breath? First chamber deadline's passed. We made it past midnight. I don't think anything blew up last night that I'm aware of.
Hi,
good morning. And so we are now officially on to our first round of Senate bills. And this morning, we have five Senate bills up for public hearing, so we're going to get started on those. I believe with Senator Girard here, we'll move down to Senate Bill 645, and I will open a public hearing, Senate Bill 645. And Mr. Walker, would you tell us a little bit about this?
Representative McEwen, members of the committee, Senate Bill 645 expands the definition of vehicle of special interest to include Humvees. There is a minimal revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Senator Girard, welcome to our committee
you,
this
Chair
morning.
McEwen. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm Senator Fred Girard, representing Senate District 9. Senate Bill 645 is really a very, very simple bill in that it allows Humvees to apply and receive a special interest plate. Now, I think it's very imperative you know what a special interest plate is, so I'm going to read it, and Amy Joyce is here to answer any questions that you may have. It is simply a vehicle that are limited in use either for exhibitions, parades, or club activities. That's all they're allowed to do. It doesn't allow them to be on the open road, to go down and buy groceries or go to a different community. The reason for the bill is I have a mayor that had a Humvee, and he wants to use it in parades on the 4th of July to take expatriates and GIs and stuff through parades. So it's for veterans. It's a real simple little bill, and that's basically all that it is.
Thank you, Senator.
Any questions at all?
Chair Vial.
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, let me make sure I understand. Does the specialty vehicle situation essentially allow us to take a car or a vehicle and only use it occasionally, and thus we pay less for registration? Is that the essence of this?
Yes, it's only allowed, again, for exhibitions, parades, or club activities. That's all that they're allowed for use.
Follow-up, so, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
So I've got a 55 Chevy at home in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have it registered as a specialty vehicle.
You could get that registered. Antique vehicles, I believe, qualify.
So why
that's
wouldn't...
something you might want to ask Amy Joyce. But that's the reason that we have those type of vehicles, so that it's not for an everyday driver. It's just a one-time thing.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Other questions? Thank you, Senator. I believe we will have Ms. Joyce up. There may be further questions.
Okay, great.
Amy? So, Ms. Joyce, I have a 1936 Willys Jeep. Would that qualify for a specialty plate?
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, it just might. And it would also qualify for an antique vehicle registration, which is the same $81 one-time registration. Vice Chair Vial, I believe your 55 or 57 Chevy
55,
also
yeah.
would also qualify for the antique registration, and again, using it for things like parades, club activities. The Humvee, the subject of this bill, is in a particular situation in that your 55 Chevy or your 31 Jeep Willy is probably considered roadworthy or a street legal vehicle. The Humvee is not, and that's why a handful of folks have come to DMV and asked these to be registered as standard street legal vehicles. They're not allowed to be because they don't meet federal motor vehicle safety standards. The folks, when they buy these off the internet, they sign a waiver that says, I understand these aren't meant for roadworthiness. I understand I'm not going to be able to register it with DMVs. But this, by changing the vehicle of special interest law, it does allow these folks to use it in this particular limited situation and therefore also pay that one-time lower registration cost.
Are there other vehicles that would fall into this not technically roadworthy category that are an example that you might enlighten us with?
I believe a street rod, whatever a street rod is. I have to tell you, I'm not exactly sure what a street rod is.
Be licensed this way.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative McLean.
In Pacific University, we have a car show every year. It's a fundraiser for the Rotary Clubs. And I've seen something like those street rods that, you know, basically look like they have extra stuff under the engine, right? Things sticking out, pipes and everything. But I've noticed all of those specialty plates that basically come through town, you know, to go to that. So I'm assuming that they can go to things like car shows they have the opportunity to at least be on the road to get somewhere, or do they have to have two plates?
Chair McEwen and Representative McLean, right, so they can come to and from the event. Mm-hmm. Club activities can be things other than sitting at the parking lot at Les Schwab for, you know, hot summer nights or whatever. The plate that you're referencing, I'll hold this up because you're going to get pretty bored with me today. This is what the plate looks like, the special interest plate. So if you see one of these driving around, it's probably on an older vehicle. The antique registration is similar with different letters down the side, but that's what you're looking at.
But so just to be clear, if we pass this bill, the Humvee in question is not street legal, but it could be used on the road to get from the where the vehicle is stored to the parade ground or to a military museum for display. So it gives it a pass, in essence, to not be what you would deem at the DMV completely street legal for certain particular events. Is that characterizing this correctly?
That's correct.
Okay. Yes, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Amy. We discussed last night, I had an employee that had a Humvee, and he drove it to work every day. I'm wondering what is not street legal about the Humvee, and can a military Humvee be made street legal so that it qualifies with the Oregon DMV?
Chair McEwen and Representative Barreto, to your second question, we're not aware of any way to make it street legal. The vehicle was manufactured not to meet the federal qualifications to get you the street legal qualification. So if you're looking at things like under the FMVSS, the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, things like braking systems, lighting, occupant protection, I think is a big one, roof crush resistance, rear visibility, EPA emission standards. So all of those things fall under this umbrella of things that can get you up to being a layman's term, but a street legal kind of finding. But again, when folks buy these things, they sign a waiver saying, I understand this thing is not to be used on the street. It's not not going to be able to be registered. So there's an understanding when folks buy these things. In terms of your employee who got that, you know, I think what I can say is we have 60 field offices with 400 frontline employees, and sometimes mistakes are made. So I would imagine that might explain what happened with your employee.
Okay. Ms. Joyce, do you mind staying at the dais? And I'd like to call up Jeff Foley and Hank Porter. Please, sir, come forward, gentlemen. And if you don't mind, Amy, we may need you back. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good to see you, Hank.
Good to see you.
Good morning.
Nice.
Hi.
Please. In any order you choose, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, I'm Hank Porter from Staten. I wore what little armor I have as a city official. One never knows when one walks into the jungle what's going to see.
Oh, I think you're safe in here, sir.
I feel safe. Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome.
One of the things that maybe creates some confusion on these this issue is that AM General, when it built these things from the mid-'80s into, oh, maybe 6 or 8 or 10 years ago, to fill the Army contracts, and then all the thousands of them we've given to allies and friends, we hope, was that they built a civilian version of this thing called an H-1. They built it from 1992 to 2006, and it was built on the same line as the military ones. Maybe not the same assembly line, but the one next to it. And it was a civilianized version of this, but it's identical. It's got different paint, maybe some upholstery in it instead of the seats that the Humvees have. But they sold these things as civilian rigs. And there are a couple of thousand of them altogether. They were expensive, $80,000 then, to buy. And so so what were they doing with these restrictions? They put some of the, or tried to put some of the restrictions on civilian sales, maybe to protect their other sales. We don't know. But as far as safety equipment, these things have lights, they have seat belts, they have turn signals. They're a big, rough, tough machine, as any of you that have seen them. As far as being on the highways, this is why you never see the Army kids running around in them on the highways, is because they're not made for highway use. The Army, you never see them run up and down I-5 in groups. It just isn't possible. But these 18 and 19-year-old kids that we have in the Guard and the Army would be running these things on United States highways. But of course they are. So why not? My proposal, what I thought was a modest one, and that was to simply allow these things to be used for parades and reenactments and whatnot, basically legalizing them to a degree so that we could have them insured. We could make sure they were insurable and insured on the highways. So that's basically my presentation. I think it's a modest proposal, and I hope it can find some approval with you folks. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here. To try to keep it simple, I echo many of the same arguments. I own one of the Humvees bought online. And what I noticed is that a couple things. One is there's a thing about the uniqueness of the vehicles. These ones that are sold, the military ones, really aren't a practical vehicle. I mean, if someone were to use it on the street, just the other day, actually it's last weekend, there was a convoy that went by. It's Capusa, Oregon, where I'm from, going about 50 miles per hour on Highway 30. But they're not really a practical vehicle. They're a hobbyist vehicle for people who buy them like me. They have interest in the vehicles themselves. The thing I'm seeing is from a safety standpoint, the interior is correct. The inside of the vehicles are very raw. I don't know if you've seen one. The military doesn't put a lot of accommodations for troops, as you can imagine. A lot of metal. So not like the civilian version that has a lot of upholstery and things to bounce off of if you got hit. So they are the same ones that the military uses that you see around. But the underpinning is the same. And so one thing that's for enthusiasts like myself.
Sorry, sir. I'll need you to identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jeff Foley from Scappoose, Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, it's first time. That's fine. The confusion comes, though, is that there are civilian AM General Hummers on the road. And there's also been different batches of Humvees sold to civilians, some of which do have restrictions sold with them, some of which do not. One is currently being sold through the Marines do not have the off-road use only stamp on their SF-97 form. So they do not have those restrictions. It creates a level of confusion, I think, for hobbyists, as well as, depending on where you live and what state, have different rules. And so one thing, as an enthusiast, you see is it takes one search on eBay to find people who have licensed Humvees at different states. and sell them, of course, across borders. One thing when I saw this bill come up was, of course, being an enthusiast, I was interested, as well as it creates a very controlled and very limited way to use them for really, the intents, which is for someone who has a healthy respect for the services, who there's enthusiast clubs specifically for old military vehicles, and actually the Jeep is a very popular one.
Shift on the column.
Shift
didn't
the column.
Make very
yeah.
many of them.
Absolutely, but you see them, even Skipoops, and there's a lot of car shows. There's a gentleman who has a Jeep who shows up. The kids love it. Mm-hmm. I have three kids of my own. Right now we just use it to work on it. It's fun. Just buy parts on eBay and work on it. And it's a hobby. And I think one thing that this bill does that I appreciate is it creates a very controlled, a very restricted way to use these and takes away the confusion. And one thing is enterprising people are is they find ways around it. I've seen Humvees sold on eBay that were civilian originally. They just took off the body, put the military on, and then it's, for all intents and purposes, the same as the military because they want it to look that way. These are very modular vehicles, which was how they were designed. And I think this is a really controlled way to do that, as well as I just, from just a precedent standpoint, Willys is a great example. Is this has been going on for years and years. The military has been selling surplus vehicles for years. Enthusiasts have been having them, using them in limited fashions. This applies to aviation. This applies to, obviously, ground vehicles, even marine vehicles. You'll see boats every once in a while come by that are, enthusiasts. So I think this is a very, very limited way to use these in the way I think it's intended. It has negligible effect, I think, on, budget, emissions, other things. To me, it was very heartening to see a really common sense bill that allows enthusiasts to kind of display their patriotism, participate in parades for veterans, and honestly, for the next generation, put some pride into the services for no expense to the government, which is fantastic. So that's just my piece.
Ms. Joyce, so I think one of the questions that's bubbling up for me is if this bill passes the way it is written right now, I live on the South Coast. If I wanted to take my Humvee to a parade in Portland, this license would allow me to put that vehicle on the freeway and drive it to Portland. Is that correct? How limited is this bill in?
Chair McEwen, I don't know that I can answer that right at this moment. I think I may have to go back and research a little bit. I guess the way that I and the department have thought about these things is that it is quite limited in scope. The parades, getting to and from club activities. I suppose if a person made an argument, well, I live in Ontario and I want to drive to the parade in Coos Bay, now you're talking about quite a trip.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I would say is I'd have to research that and see if that's constrained in the law or the administrative rules at this time. I'm not sure, and I don't want to
those safety
that
issues that you mentioned around braking and all of these other things that create an issue. I'm just trying to get at the safety issues around this. I use my vehicle for parades at times. I certainly do not want to drive that on 101. It doesn't go fast enough. So I trailer it when I want to be for military parades, because I've done that a few times.
Right.
But I'm curious as to whether there's a restriction in here to actually take a vehicle that maybe not have those safety features that we're all interested in and expose it to. A question.
Yeah, Representative McLean.
Well, along those same lines, I've watched some of those vehicles. I didn't sound very car savvy, and I'm not, but I did see some of those vehicles, on trailers, that they'd actually brought them to Forest Grove on a trailer. So to me, those were the ones that had come a longer distance, because who wants to go 15 miles an hour or 20 miles an hour with some of those cars? So they did that. They trailered them. Mm-hmm. And I just assumed that for long drives like that they would be trailered, because they have limitations, whether it be, I don't know about Humvees, but at least these older cars have limitations.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I'm willing to go with the flow on this. I'm just
sitting here feeling very old that Humvees are now seen as a collector's.
Wait a few years, Representative Evans.
Because yeah. Those things were designed to go pretty much everywhere, and I've taken them in all kinds of places. So it is, to me, different than like a duck or a truck or something else like that would be in parades. But interesting idea.
Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, Amy, I think if I'm correct, and I wasn't sure about what program we were talking about, but now that I'm beginning to understand what we're talking about, I think this is correct. Whether you're a 1915 Model A rolling down the road at 40 miles an hour, because that's really the extent of what a safe speed would be in that vehicle, if you've got this license, you can take it anywhere, and you can participate in those car shows, road rallies, all that sort of thing with the license that we're talking about. Is that correct?
Chair McKeown and Vice Chair Vile, that's correct.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I think the answer would be there really is no, as I remember reading the law, there's no limit on how far you can take it or what road you can take it on at this point, which, as I hear the testimony from these gentlemen, wouldn't be a problem with the Humvees either. We're talking about vehicles that would be clearly as safe as an old Model T. I think you've got
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, going along with what Rep. Vile said, 1915 was the Model T, not Model A.
Thanks.
But,
yeah. Yeah.
But as far as safety features, the Humvees were never licensed then for the road, and so the Model T or A was at one time. Mm-hmm. So is that the distinction then between between what we're talking about?
Yeah, Chair McKeown and Representative Barreto, I mean, I think that's a fair comparison. I mean, if the vehicle was able to be registered at one time, I mean, certainly that happens if you have an older vehicle and the rules change over time. If it was legal when it was built,
yeah,
then it continues to be available to be registered.
Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. As I understand it, it really has to do with intent. If you're using it as the plate was designed, mm-hmm, then you're fine. And that may mean even a cross-state jaunt. But if you use it outside of that, then it's up to the officer to actually prove that it is an infraction. And if you apply for this plate falsely, it's a crime. So.
Correct?
That is correct, Chair McKeown and Representative Noble.
Thank you. Any further discussion or questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming here today. We appreciate your insight. We appreciate your input. We will close the hearing on House Senate Bill 645.
Thank you.
And safe travels home. There you are.
I might go buy one. I've already found the website. It's going to be awesome on the farm.
One's later. Okay, we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 35. Ms. Joyce, I think you're back at it.
Tim? Representative McKeown, members of the committee, Senate Bill 35 increases from $1,500 to $2,500 the property damage threshold amount that must be met before a person is required to submit a motor vehicle accident report. There is a no revenue impact issued and a minimal fiscal impact issued.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair McKeown and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation here on Senate Bill 35A. This is a proposal for efficiency, and what it would do is increase the monetary threshold for when you have to report an accident to the DMV. So under current law, you have to report to the DMV if there's a fatality or an injury, if a vehicle is towed from the scene, or if there's property damage of $1,500 or more. Now, the last time that monetary amount was set was 2003. Before that, it was $1,000. So over the last 14 years, with inflation and the differences in cars, the way they're made and how much they cost to repair, I would suggest to you a $1,500 damage estimate can be a very small incident. What happens when somebody submits a report to the DMV is it goes through many processes. The DMV collects those reports. They sync them up together. So if they get a report from one person and there were multiple vehicles, they're going to go out and search for the other reports from the other people. So there's the going out and chasing people down for their crash reports. Once they get all that information assembled, then they turn it over to our crash accident reporting group, which codes all this information into our system. And the information is used for decision-making within the department and by local jurisdictions who use our data. So we use it for engineering and project decisions. And in our transportation safety division, we use it for making decisions about where to award federal grant money for education and enforcement, that sort of thing. So it's very valuable data, the data that we use. And quite frankly, we are not using the data for these low-level property damage-only crashes. So DMV is collecting the data. We're reaching out and grabbing it from people and hassling them to turn in their reports. Then we're turning it over to our crash reporting folks to do all this coding. They're doing all this coding on reports and information that nobody's using. So we propose to raise that level to $2,500, slightly higher severity of crashes. So we'll be more efficient at DMV, at our transportation development division, and it will be much better for customers who won't have to be reporting these very low-level crashes. So that's the proposal in this bill.
Thank you. Questions for Amy? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 35A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 36.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, Senate Bill 36 specifies that the Oregon Department of Transportation may waive by rule the requirement that a person seeking a motorcycle endorsement to operate a three-wheeled motorcycle pass a skills test, release a requirement for driver license or permit applicants, provide information about permits issued to them previously or about previous suspension or revocation of driving privileges. There is a revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact has been issued. We have in front of us a -1 amendment that adds the terms limited-term commercial driver license and limited-term commercial learner driver permit to clarify the applicability of citizenship requirements to certain commercial driver's licenses and commercial learner driver's permits. You will probably remember that we had a House bill that had to do with auto cycles, which is a different creature. Three-wheel motorcycle is more like a trike as opposed to the auto cycle, which has the two wheels in front and this. So as not to try and confuse these things, I will stop.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. I'd also like to call J.L. Wilson and Suman Narayanan. Was I close?
Yes, you were.
Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen. So as I understand it, we have a two-part bill here.
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, that's correct. So there are two parts to this efficiency bill for DMV. The first aspect, as Mr. Walker indicated, has to do with three-wheel motorcycle testing. So again, under Oregon law, if you get a standard motorcycle endorsement, that allows you to operate either a two-wheel or a three-wheel motorcycle. You can also, or instead, get a restricted motorcycle endorsement that only allows you to operate a three-wheel motorcycle. We issue about 45 of these things a year. We only do the testing in 5 offices. So I can tell you that it's quite inefficient and it's quite cumbersome for those few customers who want to come and test at our office. When you get a standard motorcycle endorsement, you take the Team Oregon class, and if you pass that, which involves lots of teaching and knowledge testing and skills testing, once you pass that class, you come to the DMV, you take another motorcycle knowledge test, and you can get your endorsement. Team Oregon doesn't train three-wheel motorcyclists. They don't have that capability. They don't have that curriculum. And so what the law says, if you want that restricted motorcycle endorsement for a three-wheel, you come to DMV, you take a knowledge test, and then you take a skills test in the parking lot of DMV around some cones on your three-wheel motorcycle. And again, 45 or so of these a year. The test is probably not real indicative or contributing much to safety. We don't see any kind of differentiation in crash rates for three-wheeled motorcycles. So the proposal here is to allow DMV to waive that skills test for those few folks who want that restricted motorcycle endorsement to drive their three-wheeled motorcycle. So that's the proposal. The second part has to do with application questions. So the law says that DMV, when you apply for your driver license or apply to renew it, you have to indicate on the form where you've had a driver license before, when, whether you've been suspended or revoked. And quite frankly, DMV doesn't use this data for anything. Today what we use is what's called the Problem Driver Pointer System, or PDPS. All the states use the same system. We ping that system when you apply, and it tells us if you're currently if you currently have a hold on your license, so a suspension or a revocation. And if you do, we're not going to issue that license to you. You're going to have to go clear that up before we'll issue. So the proposal here is to remove the requirement that we ask those questions of customers on the application. Again, we're not using the information. It's confusing for customers. They get concerned that if they put down the wrong information, now they've put down false information on an application. So that is the proposal in the second part of Senate Bill 36.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wilson, welcome.
Thank you. Chair McKeown and members of the committee, I'm going to speak to the Dash 1 amendment to the bill. It's my understanding that there will be a Dash 2, which will simply be the Dash 1 with an emergency clause.
Hold on one second.
Yes.
Am I not...
I did not receive the Dash 2 in time to vote, please.
Okay, so we don't have a Dash 1 or a Dash 2 up here
there
today.
Should be a
I'm not seeing it.
The Dash 1 is on hold list.
Bill 6. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in the my apologies. I'm in the wrong bill. Operator error. There we go. What a typo does to you. Now, Olis is not responding. Just give us one second here. There we go. Okay, please proceed. Thank you for your patience.
Sure. Let me just state at the outset that this is an issue we've been working on with ODOT since about this summer as the problem arose. So I would hope that ODOT considers this a friendly amendment. In fact, ODOT ran through their normal channels to...
Mr. Wilson, we'll need your name for the record,
please.
Oh, thank
you. J.L. Wilson with Public Affairs Council representing Daimler Trucks North America.
Thank you.
On Senate Bill 36. Just for by way of context, Daimler Trucks North America is headquartered in Portland, Oregon. This is where they conduct all their worldwide R&D for their trucking units. They have their engineers. And the reason for this particular bill and the problem that we are trying to solve is, as you know, Daimler AG is headquartered in Stuttgart, Germany. And so Daimler Trucks North America gets a fair number of engineers coming in from Stuttgart to its Portland location in order to perform its research and development work out of its Portland location. Under current law, if you have a German CDL today, you can obtain an Oregon CDL. And so that transferability is already there, and that opportunity exists. The issue is if you've got a DTNA engineer coming from Stuttgart that does not currently has a CDL but needs a CDL to perform work in Oregon, they are precluded under current law from getting an Oregon CDL under that scenario. You also have the scenario that Suman will allude to, in which you have an Oregon CDL, the CDL has expired, and now you can't renew under current law. And so I think Suman will demonstrate having a CDL is critical for the R&D components, what they do, the testing, getting the data acquisition and things like that. But we need a way for Daimler engineers to be able to get CDLs to perform this R&D work out of its Portland facility. So I'm going to stop there. That is what the Dash 1 amendments do. The Dash 2 amendments are similar simply the -1 plus an emergency clause because we need to solve this issue today. But with that, I'll turn it over to Suma.
Thank you. Welcome, sir.
Good morning, Madam Chair McCune and representatives. Really nice to see you here. My name is Suman Narayanan. I'm the engineering manager responsible for driver assistance and safety. I work for Daimler Trucks North America in Portland, Oregon. My primary responsibilities are to develop autonomous features on trucks that aid towards accident reduction. Last summer, I had the opportunity to present in front of Representative McLean and a few other colleagues. Mm-hmm. The objective here is for me to make a case on how the inability to renew my CDL has affected my work. I have been in the States since 2008. I got transferred from Mercedes in Stuttgart, and I came in from Germany to the States. And I'm a legal citizen of India, and I'm here on an H-1B visa, a worker visa. I acquired my CDL sometime in 2012, 2013. And the purpose of me acquiring my CDL was to put myself in the perspective of our drivers and the customers. And it has been extremely helpful to understand what the drivers go through and how these trucks are used. Until about 2016, this was never an issue for me. I have been to customers. CMEX is one of our customers in Oakland, California. I've been there to troubleshoot some of their vehicles. I've been to Winnipeg region where Bison, one of our biggest customers, had a radar issue, and it was a lot easier for me to put myself in their shoes and experience a problem and then arrive at a solution at a rapid rate. And now, since 2016, when I went to renew my license, that is when I was told about the new rule that says I either have to be a permanent resident of the United States or a citizen of the United States in order to renew my CDL. That has affected my job significantly because I'm a primary spokesperson from engineering perspective on autonomous vehicles, and it has hampered, in fact, crippled my ability to demonstrate some of the technologies that me and my team puts out myself. So I'm dependent on my team members, and most importantly, I'm missing a very valuable piece of understanding what the customers experience, what we can take back from that and put into the technology. So that is my case, and requesting an ability not only for me but engineers like me to not be curtailed from having their CDL.
So just to be clear, there's two issues here. One is you've had this ability, and now you're not able to renew it because it expired.
That is correct.
But when you bring new engineers in, they can't get a CDL at all.
That is correct.
Okay. Ms. Joyce? Enlighten us, please.
Chair McEwen, I think we do consider this a friendly amendment, and we're fine with it. The idea here is that the law was changed based on an understanding of federal law. Federal CDL law is quite restrictive and voluminous. You're going to hear about it in another bill coming up here in a few minutes. And the understanding when the Oregon state law was changed was that the federal government required that only folks who were U.S. citizens or permanent legal residents could obtain a CDL. That understanding has changed, and we now believe that it is acceptable federally to grant what is effectively a limited-term CDL for people who are legal immigrants here in the U.S. legally, but not permanent U.S. residents. Mm-hmm. And so what the -1 would do is take us to that place where we could issue a CDL to someone like Suman.
And I believe the -2 is now up on OLIS.
If I may, Chair McEwen.
Yes.
Regarding the -2 and the emergency clause. So to create what is effectively a new credential for DMV is not something that we can simply flip a switch and begin issuing it the day after a bill is signed. So there is work that will need to be done, including with our third-party vendor who issues the cards I think what we need to do is work with Mr. Wilson on the most expeditious way to make this happen. But I will tell you that I don't know that an emergency clause that would require us to issue immediately upon governor's signature would be, as a practical matter,
helpful,
doable.
Okay.
Can I ask a little, Representative McClain,
can I
of course.
Ask a little bit more about that? The third-party vendor, could you just talk to me a little bit about that? What does that mean?
Chair McEwen and Representative McClain, when you get your driver license from DMV, your CDL, Class C, when you get it or it's renewed, what you get at DMV is a piece of paper, basically. That's a paper imprint of your license. We have a private third-party vendor centrally located. We call it central issuance. And all of the plastic comes out of that that manufacturing site. So we don't do that internally. We have to work with our vendor for them to be able to produce a new kind of card, what that looks like, how to make the coding work between our systems and their systems. So it's something we do when there's a change to a card or a new kind of card. So that's an element of what needs to be done to make this work.
Can I follow up with that?
Yes,
so is it because of our old computer system?
Chair McEwen and Representative McClain, yeah, I think that's part of it, right?
All right. Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, Amy, I know that we've got a system where we can issue a temporary card when we're waiting for that plastic to be produced. We do that with just Class C licenses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that maybe we couldn't immediately, like the next day, accommodate this, but rather than wait until October or whenever the bill would become effective without an emergency clause, is there any reason not to put an emergency clause in?
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Vile, if I understand the question, the only reason not to put in an emergency clause is the practical ability to issue the credential. I will reiterate that we consider this a friendly amendment, and we're committed to working with Mr. Wilson on how to do this in the most expeditious fashion we can.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
And then the other question I had as I was listening is, truck driving is really an interstate activity. Mm-hmm. What's the situation with other states as it relates to this question?
Chair McEwen and Representative Vile, I don't know the answer to that. If you would like, our DMV CDL expert is in the room to assist me on the next bill, and
right.
I might be able to call upon him to come up and see if he knows that answer.
My follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
My curiosity arises out of a hope. I'm feeling that this is a very legitimate request, mm-hmm. and especially when it affects safety on the road. And I'm sensitive to the idea that maybe we ought to do all we can to find a way to get this situation solved immediately, and then we can work out the details of something that has to do with how plastic gets printed. And maybe that also entails looking at what other states are doing. So that's the reason for my question, and I would hope we would be vigilant in that respect.
Other questions for this panel? Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Vile does bring up a great point, and that is when you do get a temporary registration or temporary, just a piece of paper, but it allows you to go ahead and perform whatever you're doing. And so why wouldn't if you had the emergency clause and you applied and you got this temporary piece of paper, but then that was also sent to get your plastic card later, why wouldn't that just apply at that time of the license?
I think what I'd like to do is excuse this panel and invite the expert in the field up to answer these questions. I think we may have a little more success, if you don't mind, Representative. Gentlemen,
thank you so much.
We understand that there's a problem we are going to try and help solve here, but let's get our questions answered. Thank you. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Letting me off the hook here, will you please?
That's right. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Russ Kassler. I'm the senior CDL policy analyst for ODOT DMV. And where should I begin? Which question should I start with?
I think the question at hand is the timing. Why can't we expedite this?
Sure. That's a very good question, Madam Chair. So there are some additional concerns in addition to the printing of the card. That is one component of it. We have to work with our vendor, Morpho Trust, to make the card, the actual image, for the permanent piece. But Representative Vile asked a very good question. Why can't we just issue them a temporary? Unfortunately, federal regulations require us, when we issue a privilege for a commercial driving privilege, to notify what's known as CIDLIS, the Commercial Driver License Information System. And because when we issue temporaries, they're on paper, we have no way of notifying CIDLIS that that issuance has occurred. So, I know. Unfortunately, there's no easy way to issue somebody a piece of paper that can grant them commercial driving privileges. They operate, because of the federal regulations, differently than non-commercial driving privileges that you or I have.
Madam Chair?
Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, you're telling me that unless the plastic is generated from the central agency, you can't push the button that notifies this federal-based central record-keeping facility. Is that what you're telling me?
Madam Chair, Representative Vile, it's a little more complicated than that. On our side, we have programming changes that we need to make to our system. So to the question, is this because of our old system? Yes, in part that is. We have to make changes in the code that will allow us to issue. Right now, it's looking for a particular legal presence indicator when a driver applies for commercial driving privileges. So we have to make the changes that will allow that to go on the record, that will send the information to our vendor, and it will notify CIDLIS.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well then let's go back to this interstate question that I asked a minute ago. We've got a whole bunch of other states that I'm guessing have figured out how to solve this. And their drivers can come in to Oregon and pick up a truck and test it, I assume. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Vile, yes, the regulations in this case are permissive. So states are allowed to issue what are called in federal regulations non-domiciled commercial driving privileges. A number of states in our part of the country do. I know Nevada does and Idaho does and Washington's working on it as well. It would be a less complicated thing for us to accomplish with a new system. For some states, this is a simple configuration change, and they literally can flip the switch on it overnight. But because for us, we are working on a COBOL-based mainframe system from the 60s and 70s, it requires hours of programming and testing.
So can you give me a sense of what the time frame is here? I mean, we're trying to split hairs on getting something done very quickly. Give me a sense of how long it will take you to offer this gentleman a CDL if we start today.
Chair McEwen, it's a tough question for me to answer because I'm not in our IT department that would do the programming. In the fiscal analysis, they offered that it would take approximately 200 hours to do all of the programming and testing. On our side, the business side, we have to work on administrative rules, and there is a statutory timeline for that. The sort of short-term work would take about 90 days to 4 months. So,
okay. Representative McLean.
When insurance companies or that type of thing, I mean, this is just boggling my mind. Yeah. I get all the stuff that you're saying, and I understand we have an old computer system, but there always are transitional ways to do something. And I've been given a piece of paper and told, you have insurance, but you're going to be getting a more permanent card. And so, you know, it seems like there's something that can be done. I don't know how many of these that you actually have out there potential, but it would seem like there would be some kind of a transitional manual way. It's like when all the computers go down. Do we stop working? Sounds like it. But, you know, it feels like there has to be some kind of a transitional way if we put an emergency clause on that says we really want you to do this, and that you could figure out how to do it by hand in some way at the beginning or in this transition before you get all that work done?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, we can go back and talk to the IT experts and see if there's any other way that they are aware of that the system could print the card. But from what I've been told in working with them, in order to turn on this ability in our system, that it will take a certain amount of programming.
Okay, I want to get back to two things. So I'm hearing you say this is an internal IT problem for ODOT, but there is a federal nexus as well.
Correct.
So tell me about the federal nexus and the holdup there. If we could wave a magic wand and deal with the IT problem, what happens at the federal level, and how quickly can that be expedited?
Madam Chair, the concern from a regulatory standpoint is that we need to be able to notify CBLIS. That the issuance has occurred and that the driver now has commercial driving privileges. So if the IT people tell us that there's a way for us to not only manufacture the card but notify CBLIS, then there could be some way of doing that. But again, I haven't been told that that's possible.
Okay. Ms. Joyce?
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, and two, I mean, there's sometimes this thought that the question is, what do we hand this individual over the counter? And that's part of it. Part of it is the systems interact with others. So mm-hmm. if this individual is pulled over at the side of the road and we've just handed this individual a piece of paper and it's not in the system,
right.
the law enforcement officer has no idea that this individual has legal privileges. So I will just continue to reiterate, we consider this a friendly amendment. We're going to work as expeditiously as we can to do this in an appropriate way. So we are saddled with an old system.
Thank you, Chair. I have one question. I understand the need to get it into our system. Is there any timeline that the federal government requires to get it into their system? I'm sure that the way my knowledge of the federal government, it's not instantaneous.
Madam Chair, Representative Noble, that's a very good question. The federal regulations require us to notify the operator of CBLIS, is the actual language, but within 10 days that the transaction has occurred.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Joyce, I truly appreciate your commitment to solving this as expeditiously as possible. And I just want to underscore the importance of that. We have a world-class truck manufacturer here who has decided to locate here in Oregon. They would have the opportunity to locate in many other states. They've made significant investments here in Oregon to do business here in Oregon. And I recognize that you all have your internal challenges, but this is very central to our portraying ourselves as open to business, as hospitable to foreign investment, to making ourselves open to economic development. There are very, very, very many things that come to bear here and to play here. And I hope that we can demonstrate to a Daimler that we are very, very appreciative of their decision to do business here in Oregon.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given what Representative Witt has just said, I guess my question would be, how quickly could we get supplemental information here to give us some assurance that we know exactly what we're looking at here from time frame?
Chair McEwen and Representative Wilson, I believe the committee is not meeting on Friday, but will be again
Wednesday.
Early next week. We will have information for you at committee on Wednesday, if not earlier. And I would also mention to the committee that the dash two that includes the emergency clause was at the request of the Department of Transportation. So
Thank
we
you.
Understand the need, and we are committed.
We appreciate that. And the dash two has just popped up on OLS, so it is there. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do we ever work with other states like Idaho? You said Idaho's set up to do this, and can we call Idaho and say, hey, we've got a guy, we can't do this within 90 days, but could good citizen, can you sign him up on your system, get him going, and then we'll take him back in 90 days? Or Or would he have to become a
moved to Idaho?
That increasingly is the answer.
Chair McEwen, Representative Brown. It's a good question. We would have to talk to school, Idaho. Similar to Oregon, they have their statutory requirements to at least establish residency. Yeah. And I don't know that we could get past that, but we could at least try. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I think from the comments you're hearing from the committee, I think it's fair to send a very clear message to our friends from Daimler that we're going to do everything we can to help expedite this as quickly as we can. We understand that there's a need here. We want to send the message that Oregon is open for business and that we welcome these incredibly skilled foreign workers to Oregon, and we want to make sure that the work is getting done here. So thank you for your willingness to help us expedite this as quickly as we can. We'll look forward to an update next week. Any further questions? All right, I'm going to close. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 36. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 37.
Representative McEwen, members of the committee, Senate Bill 37 modifies laws relating to commercial driving privileges. Senate Bill 37A makes several changes to the Oregon CDL statute to conform with recent federal regulations. These changes include electronic submission of medical certification of fitness to operate commercial motor vehicles, clarification that persons who are citizens of countries with a compact of free association with the United States may obtain a CDL.
Welcome again.
Thank you. Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and with me is Mr. Russ Kassler, who I will refer to as my lifeline on this bill. Senate Bill 37 is the department's bill that we bring almost every session to sync up Oregon's laws with any changes that have happened in federal regulations around the world of CDL. So again, nearly all CDL regulation is found in federal law, federal regulation. And nearly all of CDL law in Oregon is baked into Oregon statute. So we come here again in 2017 with this version of the changes to CDL law in Oregon. Usually when I come with this bill during a session, Bob Russell from the Trucking Association comes up with me and we join hands and say, yes, we agree, this is what we're doing and what needs to be done. Mr. Russell informed me he couldn't be here today, but he did submit a letter in support of the bill. So know that the Trucking Association is in agreement with the provisions and that they're necessary under federal law. So the biggest change in the law has to do with the medical certification program. Today it's a manual process, and what the feds are going to is a sort of a national database or pointer system in which the doctor, after performing the exam and finding the person medically fit to operate a commercial motor vehicle, will upload that information electronically, and then the DMV can ping that and know electronically that the individual is medically certified. So it saves truckers and their companies from coming into the DMV or mailing documents into the DMV. It's going to be much more efficient for truckers, their companies, and for the DMV. And we'll actually see a pretty good savings when we go to this system. Other changes in the bill, again, allowing individuals from the nations of the Compact of Free Association, the COFA nations. We have a significant population here in Salem, and I'm sure you've all heard about them. Federal guidance has changed so that individuals from COFA nations can also obtain CDLs for eight-year duration. And updates some definitions and allows DMV to retest individuals if there's a concern that they are not truly qualified to operate commercial motor vehicles. We are allowed to retest them under this bill. So that's fundamentally what the bill does, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, do we have a sense of how many hours it's going to take to reprogram the computers to deal with this one?
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Vile, I'm so happy you asked that question, truly. This is one that was going to take thousands of hours to reprogram the computer. The fiscal on this was about $1.5 million. The majority of it was computer coding. What I can, and I will say that a large portion of that was going to be covered by a federal grant that are issued for these purposes, since they're federal mandates. You've all, I hope, been made aware of the Service Transformation Program. So the 2015 legislature invested in a 10-year, $90 million program of projects over that period to update DMV systems, both the IT systems and the business processes. Because of the dates where all of this is going to come to fruition, we're going to be able to bake this into that that new system that we're getting ready to sign a contract with a vendor for, this commercial off-the-shelf system. The fiscal on this now is basically an indeterminate but minimal fiscal. So it's a fantastic example of the investment made by the legislature in this system, showing real dollars and cents payoff in reduced costs and better efficiency for the agency.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
So about when, assuming that this moves through expeditiously, about when would you be able to do your reprogramming so that that incoming data from the central system on medicals would be available to you?
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Vile, I think I know the answer to this. If I may, I think Russ can do a better job explaining how this will work.
For Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Russ Kassler from DMV. The regulation that requires states to have the ability to transmit and receive medical information had initially, and still technically carries, a compliance date of June 22nd of 2018. However, there were delays between FMCSA, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and AMVA, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, in the contract that will allow AMVA to do that work to make this link up happen. Which is actually good news for Oregon. That's what allowed us to wait and not do this in our system as it exists and spend $1.5 million and wait for STP. So the master specifications for states to be able to use to do the programming won't be available until the beginning of 2018. And we anticipate doing this as part of our STP, Service Transformation Program, driver system implementation. And depending on, I think that's, there's some question about whether, you know, real ID requirements may push drivers first, or our vehicle system would go first, and that would affect the implementation. The sort of latest it would happen would be around the middle of 2020.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
So as I am listening, I'm imagining the driver goes into a doctor. Doctor does the exam. Doctor, on his or her computer in the office, has the ability to upload this probably to a cloud location somewhere. But we can't get it back without a really expensive and complicated tweaking of our system. Is that right?
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Vile, I think fundamentally the reality is the federal system isn't even there yet. I think what Russ was trying to explain is that the federal system doesn't exist, so it has to exist before we can sync to it. If it existed timely, then we'd be looking at, do we spend the $1.5 million in our old system, or do we do it in the new? But they're bumping it out, so it has to exist before we can sync into it.
If I had to run my old law firm with these systems, I'd have gone broke really fast, I'm afraid.
This is the frustration of living in the world that we do, I believe. Further questions for this panel? Yes, Representative McLean.
Well, my understanding when you were in my office and we were talking about some of this, the good thing about this is that the transition is actually helping us. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's basically what you said. Mm-hmm. And the other part is that we can continue to work on paper until the system is up and going, as per federal understanding that they're the ones holding us up.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Chair McEwen.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you. And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 37, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 38.
Representative McEwen, members of the committee, Senate Bill 38 directs the Department of Transportation to reallocate monies for transportation projects funded by the Jobs and Transportation Act, House Bills 2001 and 2009. Upon project, if there is money remaining for the statutory allocation, it declares an emergency effective on passage. There is a no revenue impact issue and an indeterminate fiscal impact issue.
Welcome, Mr. Mather.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm going to walk you through Senate Bill 38. So in the 09 session, legislature passed the Jobs and Transportation Act, or JTA, that provided $960 million bonding revenue to fund specific projects that were identified in the bill. This was the first time in a transportation package bill we actually had projects identified with dollar amounts and scope actually in statute. Required us, as we made adjustments to those projects, to come back and actually change the statute. Those of you who have been in the legislature and certainly on this committee have seen me, I think, virtually every session since we passed the bill to make adjustments to that bill. Many adjustments were made in a way where if there's savings on Project X, it would automatically go to Project Y. Some of the other disciplines that were applied as we made those changes were to keep the changes within the 51 projects that are in the bill, so we did not expand to additional projects. The other discipline was dollars were only moved around within the ODOT regions where they were originally allocated, so we have not kind of violated either one of those rules. We stayed within the original 51 list of projects, and we've kept the dollars in the ODOT region where they were originally listed in the original bill. Of those 51 projects, only 9 of those after this construction season will still be active, so we are clearly on the final stages of those projects. Many of those projects, as I described, already have pre-described destinations for any savings on those projects. So even of those 9, 3 of those already have any savings generated on. So we're starting to get down to the very, very kind of end of the program. And rather than having continue to have bills to move dollars around and at the very end of the programs, we get down to what will likely be very small dollar amounts between a very few projects. This bill would move that authority with those same rules that I just described, staying within the region, staying within the original list of 51, move that authority to the Oregon Transportation Commission to make those decisions. Just from an efficiency standpoint for us, rather than every session coming back here, allowing us to work in the monthly meetings with our commission. Those will still be public meetings, will still be proposals brought forth that people that wish to comment on those changes will still have access to make those changes. If you take a look at the statutes that we've passed already to make those adjustments and apply the rules that I described, we're really talking about maybe one or two projects that are really kind of in play here for any kind of adjustments. The final thing the bill does is allows our commission to use any of these savings to apply for federal grants. The FAST Act that recently passed in Congress has a series of grant processes that states go through a competitive process and look for funds. As we have made proposals in the first round of those of that act, we struggled to find matching funds other than federal funds. So when we go forward with a grant application to match with federal funds is not near as strong as another state's application that has state funds as matching funds for those. And there's some requirements also around the amount of state funds that need to be part of that. So it gives the commission, again, the ability, if there is any dollars left in the program, to be able to use it to apply for those federal grants. Again, that'll be a decision that'll be made by our commission as part of their normal monthly agenda and open for any comment or input to our commission.
So, Paul, just to clarify, I think what I'm hearing you say is if a project is completed and there are cost savings, you're under budget, that money would go to another project in the region if there is one.
Correct.
If there is not another project in that region, then the OTC could use that to for federal match for FAST Act. Is that correct?
That in the bill isn't specifically listed in that order. The commission would have the ability, theoretically, to use those funds first for a grant application rather than for another project.
Okay.
Yeah. They have the ability.
Representative McLean.
I think that's really important for it to be fluid like that because, I mean, it's trying to be, you know, so we can react quickly. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to go, if we need grant, you know, money and we need some kind of a match, it means that we're trying to bring more dollars back in for more projects. And the other issue that I had was basically that this is just for the interim. We have a new investment package that we're working on. And so as we go forward on that, we will not always necessarily keep that permissive right. issue with the Transportation Commission, but that it would go back to a legislative process right. because, again, we'll have many more projects or right. many more issues or programs or balanced transportation ideas that we want to have that money spent on if there's savings.
Correct. Madam Chair, mm-hmm. that's correct. This only applies to those 51 projects and, again, nine that are left to work on. And many of those already have pre-described destinations for savings already in statute. So it's a really, really small amount and really small amount of dollars that we're talking about as we're getting down to the last year or two of this program.
Other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Mallett.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing. Pardon me, on Senate Bill 38. Mr. Walker, next week, we have a light agenda, I believe, next week.
Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, that is true. We have two Senate bills that we have not looked at yet. One is Senate Bill 344, which is the Senate counterpart to Representative Barreto's off-road vehicles bill, and Senate Bill 532 relating to lane of travel, and this is the bill that attempts to regulate driving in the left lane of the highway.
And I believe we'll also look forward to a report back from ODOT on the Daimler issue as well. Now, because we have such a light agenda next week, would you all be amenable to a 9 o'clock start as opposed to an 8 o'clock start?
Sure. Madam Chair? Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I would like to maybe consider working some of these bills as well when we do that. Yeah.
Maybe we should bump that to 8:30 if that's the case.
Shoot, I shouldn't have said anything.
I have a really? Sneaking suspicion that the left lane driving bill may draw some witnesses.
Yeah.
So if we're going to hear that bill, I think we want to rethink our start time, and let's move it to 8:30. Mm-hmm. Mr. Walker, if that's amenable. Is everybody amenable to that idea?
Sure.
All right. On that note, thank you all. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
On that note, thank you all.